Welcome to episode 54 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper. Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about my online classes, workshops, how-to books, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, and my new papermaking masterclass, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com. Today I'm talking with Richard Flavin, who I interviewed when I was in Tokyo in November of 2019. You might be familiar with Richard's illustrations of Japanese papermaking in Tim Barrett's book, Japanese Papermaking. Richard grew up in Boston, and he learned about woodblock printing and handmade paper when he was in the army in Korea and traveled to Japan, where he has lived and worked since 1970. We met to talk about his work with paper in the gallery that he and his textile artist wife, Ryoko Haraguchi, run. I didn't get to visit his papermaking studio, Gionji Press, in Saitama Prefecture, but you'll find pictures of his papered floors and kitchen cabinets in the show notes. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Richard Flavin, welcome to Paper Talk. I'm here in Tokyo at your studio and home gallery.
Well, welcome, Helen.
Yes, thank you. Tell me, so where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dorchester, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Out in Boston.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And were you creative as a child?
I think I was. People in my family were not, but I think I was. Mm-hmm. I think the first incentive was I started. As a matter of fact, somebody gave me some Japanese paper.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I did a collage in colored paper. You know, you overlap the colors. And I did a collage of Toulouse-Lautrec.
Oh.
Kind of portrait of Toulouse-Lautrec. And I was in high school at the time, and I put it in an exhibition. And the exhibition went on to somewhere in a department store. And I sold it for $100, and I thought, wow.
Wow.
You know? So that sort of, you know, gave me an incentive, you know, to do something in art. And that wasn't the beginning, but people encouraged me. I just like to, you know, as a matter of fact, I think graphic arts were painting. I wasn't a very good painter. Still I'm not. But, line work and things like that. But should have backed up a bit and said, well, you know, the first encounter with washi was that encounter with the collage paper.
So that was in an art class in high school?
No, I don't think so. No. I think somebody gave it to me.
So gave the paper.
There were art classes in high school, but that was not part of the art class. It was just a friend or something.
Okay.
Then I decided, well, I'll go to art school. I went to art school. My father said, you're not going to make a living. But I went to art school.
And where did you go?
I went to a place called the Art Institute in Boston.
Okay.
At that time, it really wasn't a school for art, but it was a school for arts in the practical sense of graphic arts. More or less things like graphic design and things like that.
Right.
So I finished the school, and within a couple of weeks, I got a job in an advertising agency.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of said, but I showed my father that I could get a job, you know, and I did.
Yeah,
and,
good for you.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I did work in an advertising agency for a few years until, this was way back in the time of the Vietnam War, right?
Okay, yeah.
And I was drafted.
Oh.
Wow, and that was the end of work.
Right. So you were drafted, how old were you? 20?
No, 18? A little bit later, because I drafted later, because I had, I was still still staying in school.
Okay.
As well as work. Yes, it's a kind of complicated, but I started working, mm-hmm. and then I kept up my artwork at night. Mm-hmm. Going to the Museum of Fine Arts School.
Okay.
Yeah. Where I started etching.
Ah, okay.
And I wanted to learn the fine arts. So, yeah, etching and lithograph.
And
that got me involved into printmaking.
Right.
So I was, did a job, I was working in the agency, and I liked it. I liked the graphic design work and the. And then suddenly I was drafted for 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a great opportunity in, well, more so than people in Vietnam conflict, because I wasn't sent to Vietnam, right? I was lucky to be sent to Korea.
Uh-huh.
And I was so happy to get over Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was studying fine arts school, Museum of Fine Arts has an incredible Asian art collection.
Uh-huh.
Right, so and I was really, really interested in Asian art.
Uh-huh.
So, for some reason, I like drawing the line.
You're saying you were interested in Asian art because of the...
Well, because, like I said earlier, I wasn't a painter.
Right.
And I was interested in the sumi-ye and the line.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, mm-hmm. such Western painterly qualities.
Got it.
So,
So you were in Korea.
I was in Korea, and while I was there, I just absorbed all of that, you know, sumi-ye type landscape, and
uh-huh.
I just love the atmosphere of it, all the smoky atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
It was just incredible to be in Asia, Asian society.
So did you go to museums? And I mean, you were working during the day. So what was your day-to-day life like during the war?
While I was working in America?
No, in Korea.
In Korea?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, the military is kind of very odd in some respects.
Yeah.
You get sent to some school for training. You know, most people do not actually do soldiering, right?
Right.
Some background work, liaison or maintenance or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent to a school to learn how to sew.
Oh.
And when I got to Korea, they said, "What did you learn? What is your military occupational specialty, MOS?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, I was in sewing class."
Uh-huh.
And what? In Korea, no soldiers sew.
So what was it? Sewing uniforms?
Or? Yeah, or repairing cuffs on uniforms and things like that, so I could run a singer.
Uh-huh.
But it was useless.
In Korea?
In Korea.
Oh, okay.
I said, "Well, what did you study?" And I studied art. Okay, well, maybe we can send you to paint trucks.
Okay.
So I guess I painted trucks. Painted trucks for a while. And then the postman was going back home to America. They said the postman's position is open. Anyone want to take the postal examination? And I said, yes. So I took the examination and became the postman for the company. So I was the postman.
Okay. For the
so my day-to-day life, huh?
For the Army base?
Yes, postman. for the small number.
Small company.
So I was the postman. And that was a very good position.
Yeah. And so did you have time to go to museums and things like that?
That's what So Korea, I had time to visit various museums and things. And so it was a very, in a sense, extremely fruitful trip for me because I could come to Japan at that time.
Okay. So did you come during that 2 years or at the end?
During the 2 years. Everyone in the military gets quite a long vacation. Because they're on special duty outside of America. So so-called hardship duty, but it was not, believe me, for some people it wasn't very hard at all. For others it was hard, but anyway. So I spent not quite 2 years, a year and a half. And then I was free, and then I was out.
Right.
And I was back in America. And of being back in America at that time, it wasn't so nice, actually. Trying to, you know, in the age of Vietnam and the political situation and everything.
Right.
And I said, I'm going back to Japan. To Asia. So the place to go was, what are you going to do in Asia? I don't know. But I went, but I came back. And what I did was I just had enough money to stay in Japan for a while. I went to Kamakura. Actually, I met some people in Korea. A teacher of ours, and he introduced me to someone in Japan, and that person introduced me to some place to visit in Kamakura. I said, you know, don't go to these cheap bars or places when you're here. He said, visit Kamakura. And so I went down there and he said, this is the name, telephone number of a monk. You can go to this temple and stay there. So I did. It just blew my mind to go to a temple and be able to stay in the temple. This is wonderful. So that was my introduction to Japan. Gardens and things like this.
Right. And this was in the 70s.
This was in the 70s, right.
Right.
And early then, 70s.
Okay, early 70s. And then you ended up going to school and discovering paper.
Yeah, but I had to get some work because I had running out of money.
That's right. Okay.
So I eventually came to Tokyo and I did start working in an English teaching position. Which most young people have to do to get some money, right? So I started teaching English, and then in English school, private teaching of students, one of the students says, you're interested in art, I know, so I'll introduce you to one of my friends who's a professor at the university. So he introduced me, and he said, you take an examination for the university in Tokyo.
To get in.
Yeah. I said, oh, I would love to in the French department. And he said, well, here's his name, you go over. And so I took the examination, which the examination was merely an interview and a presentation showing what you, if you had a background in art, and showing some of your works.
And so, did you have work? Had you brought work with you?
Yes.
Had something?
Yes.
To show?
As a matter of fact, when I was in the army, I was doing work in the craft shops all the time. And so,
what do you mean? What's a craft shop?
Oh, what, the craft shop is all is available for anybody in the army when they have leisure time.
Oh, okay.
Right, so,
so you can go.
Yeah, you know, I produced a lot of things in the craft shop, and I got some prizes and things like that.
So you got into school.
I got into school
for printmaking.
For printmaking, right? And I was in the school for two years, limited to 2 years. As a, it's not a degree program, just an outside student, an outsider coming in to.
Okay, so, and yeah, so you just had to qualify to get in.
That's right, and for foreign students, they wanted foreign students basically to mix with the Japanese students. So it was in the, you were in with the graduate students.
But you weren't getting.
You had a background in art, so so the it was basically in etching and etching lithography.
Okay.
Very few people were interested in woodblock, and I was.
Okay. And what school was this?
The Tokyo University of Fine Arts.
Okay. So you were interested in woodblock.
That's right, and nobody. There were basically no Japanese students in the class.
Oh, so there was a class, but...
There was a class. There was a teacher who came and gave lectures occasionally. But I shared the room with silkscreen printers and another group of people who just did other media works and things like that. But it was great. It was a great, great group and... I did my woodblocks, and the teacher would comment on them. Well, I did 2 years there, and I basically learned the woodblock from a very good book on woodblock printing. But I had the space, the university. At the end of 2 years, I said, at that time, I was getting interested in paper because I said, you know, I think there's, I wanted to learn about the good paper because I realized that for making good prints, I needed to make good, have good paper.
Right. And what were you printing on at that time?
Look, I was printing on high quality, thin, shoji kami, actually, shoji. Because my work was, bokashi, which is a gradation, a lot of gradation in black backgrounds, and not, unlike my drawings, not much line work, strangely enough, but background colors overlapping and things like that. And I needed very high quality to produce the colors, and cheap paper just did not work at all, definitely because of, you know, the Japanese style requires a lot of strength with the baron. And you press the
baron. Right, the baron.
There's
no
press and everything. But I found that it was just that traditional technique was just so, it was so unique because no press involved.
Right.
Just purely, pure and simple.
And the woodcut, so I'm not an expert in woodcut. So when you use the Baron, you're rubbing on the cut side? The paper's on top of the cut?
The paper's on top of the cut block.
And you're rubbing on the paper?
And I'm rubbing on the paper.
So instead of usually you're printing and several times. I don't know, actually.
Well, anyway, it's...
Usually you have a press, though. But
usually you have a press and you can't see the paper. But in this type of printing, which is based on the traditional ukiyo-e, because you do the color, and you can see the back of the color, and you can actually, while you're printing, you can actually lift the paper up and check it.
Uh-huh,
and right. If it's not dark enough, you can lay the paper down and do a little more hard pressing.
And so you said that you learned mostly from books, so... There was not a professor teaching how to cut blocks.
There was. His approach was unlike the traditional. His approach was there was a so-called art movement in Japan at that time, which is real woodblock could be done unlike the traditional way where the wood was carved in a very meticulous way to reproduce a certain object, a certain drawing or something like that. The other style was to utilize the wood as an active role as a visual sense in the artwork.
Okay.
So that was more appealing to the modern artist.
Okay, but you were interested in the more traditional.
Well, both in a sense. My first attraction was to look at those earlier works and then to get some hints from how they did those and how they got those color gradations. And so I went back to that and tried to reproduce that kind of very sensitive. It was difficult.
Right.
So
you were seeking a better paper.
Yes, that's right.
So how did you go about that and what did you find?
Well, I went up to Ugawamachi. This is just at the time I met Tim Barrow.
Okay, so Tim was in Japan on his Fulbright.
That's right. And he was going up to Ugawa. I'm going up to Ugawa too. And anyway, he was already up there or somewhere. I went up and the research center said, well, you come on up and we'll let you use the facility. Why don't you try making it yourself? I said, what? Well, I said, you can use the facility. So I went back to the school and they said, why don't you get a recommendation from the professor at the school? I said, okay. So I asked the professor at the school for the recommendation. He said, okay, I'll give you one, but what are you learning paper for? He said, you know, printer makers don't learn paper, they buy it. Yeah, so that was the answer in Japan. The concept is different from the idea of the Westerner who somehow has the idea that, and look, it's what happens, you know.
Right. You can do all parts.
You can all kind of, if you start understanding what you can do at the vat, breaks down all these areas. You're no longer a printmaker in some ways.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Uh-huh. So, okay, so Ogawa Machi invited you, but did they have paper makers there to train you?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes, this was a prefectural operated facility.
Okay.
And it was actually not really in its high mode in a sense. There wasn't much going on there.
Uh-huh. It was dying out.
Yeah, what the purpose of that facility was to support the local papermakers,
mm-hmm.
and to research into different materials to make different papers for clients or other people.
Uh-huh.
So, and there wasn't much need for it, basically. The prefecture just had to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just went on and on. They welcomed people to come in. Fortunately, I mean, we were the last group of people, Tim and I and one or two other people.
To be trained there?
To be trained in.
And how long were you there?
I was there for 1 year.
1 year, mm-hmm. Okay.
Tim was there for maybe two. At least he made his base in Obama,
okay.
Machi, and then he traveled all over.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But I still have a connection with that place. I can go back and use the facilities there.
Uh-huh. And you have a studio up there, too.
That's right.
Yeah,
no. I had my studio there for a long time, until 2005, which, you know, we burned down.
Right.
So, this was a great chance for us, I think, to, I get many people who ask me, how can I study paper in Japan?
Mm-hmm.
And I answer many people from abroad, and of course I say, well, that's one of the most difficult things. It's really difficult, because, as you know, papermakers here are family operations,
right.
And there were two or three centers, like the one in Ogawa,
mm-hmm.
That took people in to study, and they've now stopped that.
Mm-hmm.
People used to send letters asking, how can I study paper in Japan?
Yes.
Yeah. I said, I'd like to help you, and it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, okay, so let's just continue then. So were in Ogawa Machi for that year,
mm-hmm.
and you learned all about paper making. And were you still doing printmaking? Were you, like, because I know that was your initial interest, were you trying things out with your printing too, or was this just paper making at that point?
Well, that's how the paper making helped in my art was that being able to work in the vat and understand what happens,
mm-hmm.
in the vat was a big jump,
yeah.
to realize what you can do.
Right.
And this is what I think a lot of people in the West, as compared to the Japanese, feel about paper making. If they start paper making, they tend to go into the very traditional style and learn from a master.
Mm-hmm.
And just form sheets like the master did.
Right.
nothing wrong with this, but you can't make a living there for anything. And it doesn't, it's not the, it's not the way that the artist thinks about making
paper. So. Right, it's like a trade, just making sheets.
Yeah.
But you're an artist.
Well, I consider it, that it's different. Approach.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get, naturally the traditions are important, but if you get a certain amount of the traditions down, it's really helpful, and then you can move on to doing something that you can really, it's quite exciting to.
Yeah.
To understand these things. I mean, a lot of paper making is science, so many things you don't understand what's going on.
Right.
So you do need, I think, to have that background as well. So you can only learn it by just trying it and doing it.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Studio, my free Facebook group that has been evolving over the past several years. I'm re-energizing it in 2020 to include a monthly paper challenge. It's also a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, be inspired with new ideas, tips, and tricks, all having to do with paper, of course. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group, The Paper Studio. Now back to the episode.
What kind of experimentation were you doing? And after that year at Ogawa Machi, what happened? Did you set up a studio there?
Yes, I was lucky that after a short while, my wife and I moved to the town, and we lived in a small house, and we were looking for somewhere to have a studio. And I was introduced to the temple, of all places, that one of the first places I stayed in Japan was a temple.
Right.
And then I was introduced to an abandoned temple, which only needed a caretaker.
Okay.
And I lived in this, my wife and I lived in this temple for, 30 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Until 2005 when it burned.
Right. And so you set up a paper making studio there?
Yes, and that was quite a funny story. Funny, but I said to the, I just had before the an actual studio, I just had a shed out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the, a temple is a public space.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners, there's no owner.
Okay.
Basically, there's, there's a group of people who have rights over the temple. These are the supporters of the temple. And people who give the money,
mm-hmm.
support the temple, priest. And, but the real persons or head of the temple is the mother, so-called Mother Church, head temple.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, it's in Kyoto.
Okay.
The headset of the Rinzai Zenshu, Zen sect.
Okay.
Buddhism. So, I said to the, the head of the supporters in my group, and I said, I'd like to put up a little building here. And they said, oh, I don't think that's possible. I don't think that's possible because nobody said, nobody gave, they absolutely said, I think it's, we cannot give you permission to put up a building. I said, okay. And I, but I began to get very close to the head, to the priest who was in charge of that temple.
So this was an active temple.
Hmm?
It was active with religious ceremonies.
It's not real religious ceremony. There's a religious ceremony called the Obon ceremony.
Okay.
Obon ceremony happens once a year.
Okay.
But there's no, and that, at that time they call a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And this ceremony is in October. And anyway, that priest, my family, my wife and I began to get friendly or to know that priest quite well. And I mentioned the idea that I'd like to put up a place to make my paper.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think I can get you a permission.
Uh-huh.
I said, really?
Uh-huh.
He said, yeah, yeah. And he said, you know what? I'm going to go to Kyoto. And he said, what I'll do is, I said, listen, the building I have, I can restore, I have a building in Ogawamachi, which I will move.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, okay. And he said, you know what we'll do? He said, we're going to blow the zendo, which is an extra place to for physical spiritual training.
Okay.
But Zen can mean anything.
Uh-huh.
Can mean your daily activities.
Uh-huh.
Well, my daily activities was paper.
Okay.
So he said, you know, the only problem, he said, is what are you going to do? Suppose you leave for America.
Mm.
What are you going to do with that temple?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I guess let's donate it. He said, all right. And you will donate the zendo to the temple in Kyoto. So you'll use it and then you will donate. I said, that's fine. That's fine.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we did. So he said, okay, I'll be going to Kyoto next week and I'll get you the documents.
Okay.
So he came back. So that was the answer to the other people. They said, wow, you got it. So I got the framed
permit
to put up this building. Okay. So that's what we did.
Uh-huh.
So he was a wonderful person. And he became a very, very close friend.
Yeah.
There's a woodcut over there.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're sitting here in the gallery. How do you pronounce the gallery? Shin?
S-I-N-D-O. Sindo.
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 Sindo. Okay. Sindo. Yeah. Filled with Richard's work here.
Mm.
It's beautiful.
Mm.
And they're doing construction, which we can hear.
Right, yeah. It's unfortunate, but anyway, that's fine. Usually this is not my gallery. This is, it can be when there's no locals work.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So that's the story of how I got it.
The temple, the papermaking in the temple.
But I was so lucky that I could get a place like a temple to live in. And then a beautiful setting, it was a wonderful setting. And then after the fire, it was a heavy responsibility for the fire. And I was not home at the time of the fire, but
mm-hmm.
I don't want to think even. I don't know how it started.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to.
Yeah.
But It was my responsibility because I was given permission to be the caretaker of this place, and I was for many, many years, and I lived here basically rent-free, and my wife and I took care of it.
Right.
And when my wife died, the priest was so grateful for us to be living there.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful Zen priest, and he wouldn't take 1 cent for 1 yen for the funeral or anything like that. And he gave the space for my wife's gravestone up there.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so. Well, after the building burnt down, we had to decide what to do, and we rebuild the temple. So yes, we'll rebuild the temple. So it costs a lot of money to do this, but the supporters of the temple. Were only about 12 or 15 people, 12 or 15 families, and they're not rich families, they're just country people, so a big burden on them to spend the money to rebuild it. So I somehow got together enough money, and I put in a lot of money to rebuild it.
Oh, so it was rebuilt.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And are you still associated with it?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
So,
but you're not the caretaker.
You know. No. They asked if you were going to live there, if I was going to live there again. And I said, no, I won't. Because this is before I met Bilbo, actually.
Okay.
Was it? I think so. No, I said no.
No,
I won't live there. But anyway, it's just a temple now. Nobody lives here.
Okay.
So it's under the care of just those core people who come up there and clean around it every once in a while.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this time, you were making artwork, and do you sell your artwork or?
If possible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's kind of, Japan's going through this period of selling of art right now is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the same, I don't know, the market for artwork is pretty difficult in these days.
Yeah.
But back in the 1980s, this thing was booming. I had a relation with the gallery in Ginza.
Okay. In Tokyo.
In Tokyo.
Yeah, Ginza area. Mm-hmm.
And I never looked for, I never, by the way, this is a philosophy I have since I've been in Japan. Almost all of my life, I've just gone for something I want. Something in my head, intuitively, I knew it was going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
And coming to Japan, I said, right. I'll manage.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? I'm talking about
the Ginza Gallery.
The Ginza Gallery, right. And, I never approached the gallery. The gallery approached me, and he had a he had some clients that were not homes or not residents, not residences, not businesses. Sometimes businesses, but mainly resorts, hotels, things like that. So they had budgets for artwork.
Right.
In their lobbies.
Uh-huh.
So he was pushing me to make artwork. And I was very, enthusiastic to try new things, to play for the lifestyle things and things like that. So it worked out well.
And you had the freedom to do what you wanted, it sounds like.
Exactly.
I don't think you would have done what somebody else wanted, right? So you were able to just explore and create work.
That's right.
And he would sell you work.
Right.
Wonderful.
And he would sell my work, and I wouldn't even price it. And he would just do that.
I wouldn't frame it.
So it worked out fine for a period of maybe 15 years or so in the 80s.
Okay.
So anyway, I was going along fine at that time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And have you ever sold paper? Just sheets of paper?
Yes. Yes. Back in the, let's see, what was the 90s? Yeah, late 90s. Some people saw came up to my studio and saw my papers, and one man was a director of a craft exhibition, a wonderful old man who traveled and set up these great craft shows of people, craft people doing furniture, craftwork, pottery, things like that. And he was specifically looking for paper makers, and he found him, and he found me, and said, "I want you to join."
Uh-huh.
And I did.
Okay.
And
so this was in Japan, so it's Japanese crafts, correct?
Yeah,
but you're an American.
Japanese, that's right. And
so
yeah, it didn't matter if it did. He would pick up anyone.
Mm-hmm.
He liked it.
Right.
So that helped me.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Ryoko, one of them.
Okay, Ryoko, your current wife.
Hmm?
Yeah.
Ryoko, my partner. That's right. She had a booth near mine.
Okay.
And I looked at the garments that were the beautiful color, I thought that was interesting in khaki shibu.
Right, the persimmon,
and,
fermented persimmon
juice.
Yeah.
So we started talking about that, and one thing led to the other.
Uh-huh.
So we got married in 1999.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's been things, life goes up and down and changes like that.
Right, sure. And so you were talking earlier about people writing to you and wanting to learn the craft, and it's hard to figure out what to tell them. But you at least had Paul Denhove come work with you for some time.
Wow,
have you had other people? Or just talk about that, the mentoring you have done.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul.
Yes, for Paul. Let me see. I knew Paul shortly before that,
mm-hmm.
before he came up. There was a conference in Kyoto,
mm-hmm.
and Paul was an attendee at the conference on paper, and we were talking. So I knew him, and then I knew him in Penland.
Right, and he studied with Tim Barrett.
And that's right, he studied with Tim Barrett.
You knew him.
So.
And he wanted to come to Japan and research about paper.
Right, and he did come as
a
researcher.
Did he have a Fulbright or something?
That's right, he had a Fulbright.
Okay.
And then he talked to me on the phone from Kyoto, and he said, "My Fulbright is coming to an end.
Ah.
You know, could I come up and help you in
mm-hmm.
your work?" And I said, because I knew him, I said, "Why not? Sure, why not?"
Uh-huh.
So he was single, I was single.
Okay.
So he came up and he stayed in a couple of years.
Right.
That was it. Stayed in that temple.
Yeah. Well, he was there when the fire happened.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was there, but he doesn't know the fire. I mean, he just, unfortunately, he didn't start the fire. Unfortunately, he didn't know how the fire started, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was a great help. He still is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's still in Tokyo. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I want to get back to the integration of the paper and the printmaking.
Okay. Well, the printmaking has led me on to a lot of sort of pseudo printmaking. Printmaking itself can be, you know, I've gotten away from anything like the traditional printmaking of carving the blocks, like in the case of traditional Japanese.
Right.
But I still use the technique of taking color from the wood block onto the paper through some means, using the baron very often. But I often pick up the color in different ways from the back of the paper onto a keep an image that is already there, and then some different effects. More difficult to explain than to see. And just to give the depth into the paper, to rather than printing there are some words that are in Japanese that are, there's one word like, well, in Japanese it's a tataku horn, and tataku is to tap, and this is related to taking a rubbing, and it's not rubbing, but rather it's tapping, and that's similar to the rubbing, where you get the image from the stone, or in this case the wood, or in my case, anything. Could be the stone or any object. I look around for objects that have a relief. And in abstract work, I will pick up that relief and by the pieces we are looking at now are all done in that way. This is a traditional black and white rubbing from the stone, but it's not a rubbing, it's a tapping.
So you're inking up the stone?
No, because these stones are antique.
Historic.
And they're on the roadside.
Okay.
They're not mine.
Right.
So the very high quality paper is wet, very wet,
and then
laid over the stone.
And then you do the tapping.
And then do the tapping with a nice bristle brush, a soft brush, and indent it into the relief of the stone.
And so then do you pull off the paper is still wet, or do you leave it there till it's dry?
No, then.
And this is, the pigment is from?
Well, then we use the tapping device is a small ball of cotton,
mm-hmm.
which is folded up into a silk binder, in a sense.
So it's like a little pouch.
Little pouch, mm-hmm. yeah, like a pouch. And that's put onto a sumi ink.
Oh.
And then transfer it onto the paper, very carefully.
And that's a separate process after it's been on the stone?
Paper is on the stone, mm-hmm. and you tap it up into the recesses of the stone, then it has to seep, has to dry
okay.
on the stone.
Yeah.
Then tap the color. The sumi onto it,
okay.
and then wait a while and remove the paper.
Okay. So if I can take picture later, I'll put the picture
on the
web page so people can look at that. Yeah. Right.
So along the roadside of Japan, you find these. These are what's so called Buddhist guardians. The travelers' guardians.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so what is the paper that you're using?
This is paper that I made myself.
Mm-hmm.
This is 100% colza paper.
Colza.
Right. And this, it's one long sheet calculated so that, you know, folds up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then a silver fleck.
Oh.
Let's put on finally.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And is this a book? Or yeah.
A book, a folded book.
Folding screen.
There's a lot of these things don't survive in the outdoors. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why, because somebody finds them and steals them.
Oh. Huh.
It's a terrible thing because they shouldn't be treated that way, but that's what happens sometimes.
Right.
They wind up in a tea shop or something.
Uh-huh.
Mm. But in the countryside, you'll find them on the roadside. They're not gravestones, no.
Okay. Right.
So I look around, I become fixated on what kind of objects I can take impressions from.
Right, right. And what about these more abstract pieces?
These abstract pieces. Here again.
Is it a similar?
Yes, the process is the same,
okay.
except that I use black paper mm-hmm. and white ink.
Okay.
And the stones, again, it's scratches on either stone or, in this case, wood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they're collaged.
Okay.
Collaged into forms and shapes like that.
Right.
And so are except for the last two.
Mm-hmm.
Those are drawings.
Drawings, right. Yeah.
So I like this. I like this. Is still in a sense printmaking, but it's mm-hmm. way different from
right.
traditional.
Yeah. And are you always working with 100% koso?
Yeah, as much as possible. I make everything from paper that I make myself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And are you still making paper?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, slow down a bit, but I make when the weather's good, I make.
And have you taught? Do you teach paper making?
Yes, I've taught paper making a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taught here in Japan. I've taught in international schools, and well, that's kids.
Uh-huh.
But,
Adult
adults I've talked to, not everything, but I've talked to kids in America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we met the first time at, well, this is the only second time we're meeting, but at the paper and book intensive. We were both teaching, I think, in the late 90s.
Late 90s.
Well, Richard, it's been really a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for coming on Paper Talk.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. The reason, besides the season.